This podcast is in no way affiliated with the Stars production or Diana Gabaldone. All views expressed are solely our own. Welcome to the Outlander podcast,
where the men are kilted, the women are winsome,
and the whiskey is neat. Welcome to episode 383 of the Outlander podcast. I'm Ginger.
And I'm Summer, and we are in love with all things Outlander.
This episode, we'd like to thank co-producer Laura D. And there are still some spots left on our Pod Abroad 2022 trip, like I think 3 or 4 max. And you can find out more about that trip by going to podabroad.com. And we'd love to hear from you. If you haven't joined our text community, please do so. You can send us a text, send us a hello to 916-659-5112. This episode is sponsored by Braden Press.
And now, on to our read-along. This week, we will be continuing our A Breath of Snow and Ashes read-along with chapter 70, entitled Emily.
So Brianna and young Ian, they're still camping. She wakes up alone at the campsite and has a hard time starting a fire and wonders how the Greeks did it. And she didn't go into a lot of detail, or Diana did not go into a lot of detail, but I'm pretty sure here she's referring to Greek fire, which present day, our day, contemporary of us, archaeologists or historians don't know that formula. It's a mystery. So the fact that she's wondering how they did it is kind of funny because, yeah, they did it. They did something, but no one knows exactly what it was. And she's wondering about this right as Ian returns to the campsite. He has brought some yams. He's foraged a bit. He's brought some breakfast and he's brought some yams and a bird, but the bird was Rollo's. She's lamenting over not having brought her matches and tells Ian that the Greeks had phosphorus, and that phosphorus, she uses it in her matches. And she brings up, or she calls them her fire starters to him, because match means like a game or a contest to or it would to Ian or any Scot, really. So Ian takes over making the fire. And as he does so, she hears him reciting a fire charm in Mohawk.
Well, she hears him reciting a charm, but she doesn't know what it is.
That's true. She assumes she knows it's another language. I don't know. I don't know if it's been a little bit since I read this, took notes. I didn't write that part down. She knows it's not English. That's what she does know. But she does find out that it's in Mohawk. And what the reader or the listener finds out is that Ian doesn't think in Mohawk. Now he never said he never does or never did or never has. But it seems, at least as a regular thing, he does not think in Mohawk. So she presses him on why he seems to be not wanting to talk about it, meaning thinking or dreaming or thinking in Mohawk or this topic. Ian asks her if she'd dreamt the night before. She says, yeah, she dreams a lot. And then Ian mentions her dream book, which startles her because while she hasn't hidden it, she didn't know that Ian had read it, or let alone probably that Roger had read it. At least to the extent that he had. So Ian thinks that she must consider her dreams important if she's writing them down. And he says that the Mohawk considered dreams to be very important. And Bree shares that she had dreamt of birds the night before, live birds. And Ian says, well, that's a good sign because dead birds are not a good sign. And she says her birds were building a nest out of toilet paper, which she then had to explain to him what that was, what it meant, and he is horrified that people of any time, but specifically because she's talking about her time, would use paper or something called paper to wipe their butts with.
I mean, it is a type of paper.
But in his mind, believe he is thinking of. Now, they, I'm sure they had, like, okay, they had broadsheet paper, they had newspaper, they had writing paper, or, you know, something that they would write a letter on. So I'm sure that they had variations in paper as well. But, and so that's the only thing, you know, he, of course he saw variations, right? He, if not worked, he was around his Uncle Jamie, at least a little bit in Edinburgh, at least a little bit, to know that at a print shop, you probably have different types of paper. So he's not necessarily uneducated. He's probably better educated than we are on this, obviously.
But I want to know if he's more upset about the expense of the paper or the fact that paper of the time was rough and not great to put on your butt. Like, the leaves and things that they would use out in nature are soft.
Because I'm trying to think, would I be more horrified if someone came from the future and said, oh, we, and this makes no sense, I know, something like, oh, we use animal fur to wipe our butts.
No, what if they said, we use lasers? And you're like, wait, what? Because our concept of lasers right now is different than their concept of lasers?
Yeah, so, but paper is still paper. I mean, laser would come out of left field from some other planet. Like, I don't know how you wipe, unless you had a, what do you call it?
But just, it's just using something for a purpose that is not akin to how you would use it. So, like, we know what lasers are, but to us, lasers are lights. They are things
weapons.
That create heat. They are weapons.
They are dermatological thingies to help you with your skin.
Correct. But you would never expect somebody wiping their ass with a laser. That's what I'm saying.
Yeah, but it's also a beam of light. I don't know how that's physically possible. Whereas, however you function it, you may not. Okay, so the further you go with that, even though I still think it could be both, I don't think Ian is. I think he is probably horrified at the fact that the expense and, like, the literal waste of it, seeming waste of it, and the fact that you do what? That must hurt really bad, right? I think it's probably both, but it's probably the fact that it just doesn't compute. Whereas if someone told me about a laser, now, yeah, we have certain uses for lasers today. A laser is not something you can hold in your hand and wipe your butt with. Now, what I was thinking of was,
yeah, but
if
think
you
about
had a
all
bidet
of the,
or something,
the water
that shot
filters.
Laser instead of water. I don't know. That's the only thing that would make sense.
I know, but think about water filters. Like, there's filtration systems now that are just UV light. So if somebody told you that, oh, we filter our water with light. If you told that to somebody like 10 years ago who just found out about UV light and they're like, oh, that's a filtration system. We do it on our water things to keep algae from growing. Like, that would, it's just a concept that is foreign to the person. So it's something that you've heard of UV light, but you don't recognize that as being something that could work as a filtration system. I'm just saying it's a thing that exists in his current life, but it is being used in a purpose that it is not used by people.
But that would be wonder and confusion, not being horrified. He is horrified. So I think the horrified is probably more of a potentially an expression or a reflection of cost, maybe. But I think the horrified is this thing that people, like, yes, it's expensive, but this thing that's like a commodity, right? Or it's hard to come by, can be hard to come by, that you're using something that is that special or that hard to come across to literally wipe your ass. So I think he's horrified. I wouldn't be horrified unless you told me, like, ripped a new anal canal. That's horrifying. But if you told me lasers were used to wipe butts or clean butts, I wouldn't be horrified. I'd be shocked and, like, that makes no sense. But that's
but
not horrifying.
It would seem like, oh, like an overkill. Well, overkill for something that requires a softer touch. Which is the same with, like, paper. Why would you use paper that you write on when you have these leaves that work great? You can just use these leaves and they're soft and nobody complains and they're plentiful and you never have to worry about running out of them. Whereas why would you use a commodity like paper that's expensive
unless you stop
and also
living
not suited for it?
In or close to nature. Absolutely. So yeah, not everybody in a town's going to have, you know, a tree out in the back or a woods to walk out to do that. But yeah, either way, he's horrified. Ian, however, says he didn't dream the night before. So she asks, Bree asks him what he ate for breakfast with the Mohawk. And he replies, it has to do with my brother-in-law. And I thought, that is a non sequitur. Like, what? So she's asking him a general question. And he's like, okay, he gives her an answer, but not like, oh, well, you know, most days we had corn. I'm making this up, corn mush. And on special days we had, you know, elk. I don't know. Like he didn't give an example or even a reason. He just said it has to do with my brother-in-law. And maybe it was like, okay, you asked me about breakfast. You're triggering a memory. Okay, this thing I got to tell you. Kind of like me, right? You ask me a question and I'll say, oh, you know what that reminds me of? Blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, oh, I didn't really answer the first question. I might come back to it, but you gave me a tangent and this is what I'm going to tell you about it. That's what it sounds like. So she asked him what he ate for breakfast with the Mohawk and he replies, it has to do with my brother-in-law, meaning I think it's a tangent. So his brother-in-law was Sun Elk, of course, the husband of Emily's sister. Well, not of course. We don't know that yet. You know that if you've read. Ian wouldn't use English or Scots around other Mohawk, but he would when he was alone. So he didn't want to lose it. So he would go out on his own to the forest or wherever and talk, name trees and animals and just different things so he could assure himself that he was not losing his mother tongue. Now, Sun Elk, like Ian, would watch Emily too. He explained, or Ian explained to Bree, the Mohawk idea of marriage. Typically, the parents arranged it. So they had to marry someone from another clan. Ian had been adopted into the Wolf clan, and Sun Elk was also of that clan. So Emily had been expected to marry Sun Elk, we're guessing, you know, during their upbringing for some reason, but she did love Ian, and she said so. Ian's foster mother had spoken to the most influential woman in the village, which happened to be Emily's grandmother, and they married. 4 months after they married, Sun Elk married Emily's sister. Ian had with him the gun Jamie had left him, and Ian could track really well. He was a good hunter, and he gained respect for his ability to bring in meat. Sun Elk was a decent hunter, but only decent. And the men would joke with each other about their hunting skills. But Sun Elk was a bit harder than the others, or harder on Ian than the others. Ian tried to ignore him, but he realized what was up when he saw him looking at Emily. So Emily and her friends were going into the woods, and she told them she was looking for cedar to make a cradle board. So now everyone knew within a month of them, him, people finding out about her pregnancy, Sun Elk moved into the longhouse, now the husband of Emily's sister. So now they were in the same longhouse, and he tells Emily that someone else desires her. And she shrugs it off and says she only desires him. So whether she understood what he was saying or not, we don't know. Or at least she may have been aware of Sun Elk, but we don't know that she was aware of what Ian was trying to say at that moment. So Sun Elk comes to him the next morning and says that he dreamt of him, Ian, and that he dreamt that Rollo had grabbed him by the neck. Now, Ian didn't respond at first, and then he says that he dreamt of him too. And he did not elaborate any further except to, quote, let a slow and evil smile grow upon his face. Sun Elk turned away with a look of unease. So Ian and Bree start walking to continue on their trip, and he continues his chattiness. We find out Ian and Emily's first child died. So they conceived again, and it died. So that's number two. She had miscarried that second time. They were, quote, treated in the medicine society, which was in a ceremony in a special tent or area. And then they continued to make love, first tenderly and then desperately. And finally, she was pregnant again. Now, this time, she took it much easier and didn't go out on long walks, didn't spend so much time, you know, far away from the camp or the village, just generally was trying to be easier on her body. But a bit later, she miscarries again. So the two of them try more or keep trying, but her heart was not in it. Ian says to Brianna, quote, she didn't trust me any longer, unquote. And Sun Elk was there at their hearth, as he had been, and he started to look again at Emily, and she started looking back.
Now, make sure that you mention that when she miscarried was the same time around when her sister went missing with their baby. So I'm not saying he's not a bad dude, but there are lots of extenuating circumstances that it feels like you're just
skipping over.
Yeah.
Yeah. So when Sun Elk, so it's not just that they lost their third baby and then they grew apart and she's looking over at Sun Elk and say, come on, dude. No. So yes, what I had not taken notes on was that Sun Elk, by the time I think it was their, I don't know which baby it was, baby number two. I don't know. Maybe it was baby number three or lost number three. By the time Ian and Emily have lost their third child.
He came back from searching to find she'd miscarried.
The day or the very close time around her miscarriage, Sun Elk had lost his wife and daughter. They disappeared. They were kidnapped, trafficked, who knows, but they were gone and people had been out looking for them. So he comes back from looking for his wife and daughter to see or to find out that Emily had miscarried, and that was her third. So at this point, when she and Ian are growing apart, and Ian says that she didn't trust him any longer, she has, or I should say, Sun Elk is now, and it sounds really bad to say this, but Sun Elk is legally, officially single. he's not cheating on his wife. He's not on all that. And also, he's has a crush, but he's in mourning. He has lost as well.
It seems like they're turning to each other in their mutual grief.
I could absolutely go with that. So now they're starting to look at each other, or he's looking again, not still, but again. Well, could be still for all we know, but we don't have that in the text. But she is now looking back. And this is the first time since, to our knowledge, since Ian has come into her life or into the tribe, that she's actually looking back while Ian is still there. Emily's grandmother one day came to see Ian. She leads him away from the village. She gives him a bag of salt and an armlet of wampum and bade him go. And so he did. He didn't put up a fight. This is not a judgment. This is just an observation. Subtext. He did not put up a fight. That's the point that later comes back to one of the ones that really hurts Ian, or that he feels hurts him. So a little bit later, Ian and Brianna, they're still walking. They arrive at their goal. They walk into a gorge and he leads her to the final resting place of a mammoth. I filled in woolly mammoth, but whatever. It's a mammoth.
It's probably not woolly anymore.
Oh, no. It's if it was, it isn't now. So he starts asking her all sorts of questions about it. And she responds that it's extinct. And Ian describes that he had found the skeleton about a month prior. Quote, I came up on the gorge and there it was. I nearly beshit myself.
How confusing must this conversation have been for Ian? Because if they were extinct when Ian found them and then she's from 200 years in the future and they know not only that they were extinct when Ian found them, but what they are.
For thousands of, yeah.
But like they were able to, he's like, but if they were extinct when I'm alive and they're still extinct when you're alive, how do you know? Like just the idea of the scientific discoveries like must be like mind blowing.
Yeah. Like how exactly? How do you have more information than we do when it's already dead now?
Mm-hmm.
He says that he would have been more afraid of it, except Rollo wasn't. That makes sense because animals tend to, whatever you want to call it, they tend to can sense things better than humans sometimes, especially hearing and stuff. So she asks what this has to do with his wife. Well, I would say it has to do with what we had for breakfast to turn it all around back on his head. Come on, stick with him now, Brianna. So Ian says that he was wondering if the skeleton had been a god or a spirit and that they, gods or spirits, had taken his daughter away and he'd never seen her. And he's worried because she was never christened. He named her Ishabel. He's afraid that leaving his people, meaning the Scots or the white Europeans, leaving his people, turning away from Christianity, could have killed his child. She tries to calm him by reciting the conditions of mortal sin, trying to tell him, like, look, you basically saying you did not do this. First of all, even if you did, it wouldn't be your punishment, quote unquote, would not be wrought out on an unborn baby. Come on. But she goes over the conditions of mortal sin. One, the act is grievously wrong. Two, you knew the act was grievously wrong. And three, you give full consent to it. She says what he did or didn't do wasn't wrong. And that his daughter was half Mohawk and it wasn't wrong to let her be buried according to their ways, because they were also her ways, or would have been her ways. He is specifically worried that his baby is in limbo. He dreams of her crying at night and he can't help find her. He can't find her in his dreams. And by this point in their conversation, he's bawling. Bree says that her first father, Frank, died and or had died, and she just knew he was in heaven. She verbally cries out to him and says, "Daddy, Daddy, I need you. I need you to find Ian's little girl. Find her, please. Hold her in your arms. Make sure that she's safe. Please take care of her. Thank you, Daddy." Unquote. So as they clung together, she was crying as if her father were newly dead. And they're just basically becoming snot factories on each other. And he asks her a little bit later, "Are you sure?" Meaning, "Are you sure your dad's in heaven?" And she says, quote, "I'm a Roman Catholic and I believe in vitamins. And I knew my father. Of course I'm sure." Unquote. This environment, like a place out of time, the water, the waterfalls, an extinct mammoth, talk of God and spirit and belief, is like a church here, or a natural holy place. And Diana does this a lot, right? When Jamie, I think it's in book 5, before the War of Regulation, Jamie goes out, he's Nicky's, and he's like cutting some blood and, you know, calling upon his ancestors, including Dougal and who knows who else. And Claire sees him and kind of gives him a little bit of a berth. And then when he's done, she approaches him, or he says, "Come on, Sasanaga, I know you're there." And so that's one. He does it. I believe he does something before Culloden. I could be wrong, but something in that book as well. But periodically, he does this, and or something like it, or at least Diana does this, where she uses, if not an actual man-made church, she uses or shows us these holy encounters or holy places throughout nature. And this is another one of those times. And of course, if I'm not mistaken, indigenous, at least in North America, I cannot speak for every single indigenous group all over the world since time immemorial, but at least most if not all Native American, First Nations, etc. people on the North American continent, as I understand it and as I have read, were/are those who still practice their ways animists, which means they believe God is in everything, or everything, not that everything is God, but God is in everything. And so there is no place that is not holy. Think about that. So for the Mohawk, or for any Native American tribe, that's like the world, not necessarily a physical building that we build. That's a whole other question that I actually would be very interesting to ask someone. But their world, their natural environment, which is their environment, period, is sacred. Every place they walk, everything they see, the food they eat, the food they catch, everything is sacred. And that's an entirely different mindset or source to approach life from, or place to approach life from. And so Diana doing it here with Ian, who, yes, he is Western, but he's also, you know, part of him will always be other due to his time with the Mohawk. And so I love that Diana once again gives us this place in nature as a holy place. So Ian said that he'd brought her there, Brianna, to show her the mammoth, but also to ask her what he should do. The question is, should he go back to Emily? He knows that she loved him, and he's worried he shouldn't have let the old woman make him go. He wants to know if he should go fight for her, and potentially even ask her if she'd come back to the ridge.
I think it's too late for that.
It's too late. It's also
a lot. I just
I feel like if he was going to make that stink and make that scene, he should have done it when they tried to make him leave. At this point, it doesn't matter what he says, because she's going to, even if they told her he left of his own volition, he'll never be able to prove it. So it's like, whatever story they told her, because we don't know if she was behind them asking him to leave or if it happened as a side thing that had nothing to do with Emily. Like if she just woke up one day and they said he's gone, he left. He left during the night or whatever. Whatever they told her, if he didn't try to take a hold of the narrative at the moment, he's never going to get the narrative back. It doesn't matter. It's too late.
So within her mind, Brianna's like, I can't, this is not my, like, I can't make this determination. This is not my role. She's feeling very overwhelmed and like, she doesn't want to play this part. But then she realizes or decides that whether I want to or not, I'm here and he's asked me. And I have to say something. That's a very difficult place to be. And you don't want to be the person who says go or stay and have it be blamed on you either way. Because that's a lot. It's not loaded. It's just a very heavy question to ask someone who's really not involved.
And she doesn't know.
She doesn't know. That's what I'm saying. And so she has to just go with her gut or go with her best guess. And so she's like, she bucks up and does what she believes. At the very least, whatever her answer is kind of secondary. It's not really. But regardless of what she wants to say or doesn't want to say or is confused about saying, she is putting Ian first. Ian is, I don't know. I mean, maybe you call him desperate. Whatever he is, he's opened himself up in this very...
He's vulnerable. He's made himself vulnerable and he's second guessing all of the choices he's made to that point. And he was like, is me finding this thing?
Yeah.
Is this the sign that I should have done more? And it's just a thing and it died there. It died there thousands of years ago.
That's interesting. You say, is it the sign? Because maybe... Because he learned from the Mohawk that their dreams are so, you know, mean so much.
And animals are symbols, both in life and in dreams.
Well, yeah. But it's interesting. It's just interesting that you say, because he doesn't say, does this sign mean that? And he may be thinking that. But anyway, it's just interesting that you say that. And so Brianna, and because he didn't say it to Brianna. He just says, should I stay or should I go or fight for her or whatever? He doesn't say, does this sign mean that I should do this? Now, he may mean that. It may, the mammoth itself, probably the experience at least, probably was something that got his mind and emotions churning to want to bring her there. I don't know if he planned to ask her there, but he definitely wanted to show her. So maybe it's just everything upon everything upon everything. Maybe he didn't plan it, but I can absolutely see how he might wonder if this experience with the mammoth, even before Brianna was brought there, right? Him finding it and like having this sense of awe, if that was a sign.
Imagine, if you will, being a person of this time who has no idea what a woolly mammoth is and that it resembles, you know, an elephant, a big furry elephant. All he sees are the bones. He doesn't know what they mean. And to them, this could have been some Mohawk ancestor, like some great spirit god. This was the proof that the spirits existed. You know, this could have been something that as a Mohawk, if they'd found it, would have had great significance to them. So him having lived with the Mohawk, but also being of, you know, the colonists and of the Scottish descent, like he's been straddling all these worlds for so long that he's like, this feels like it means something for me to have found this now. Does this mean something?
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. I can believe that his stumbling upon it, even if it doesn't mean diddle, right? At the very least, it's impressive. Even if there's nothing deeper than that. What is it? I don't know, but it's definitely impressive. But yeah, I think because of his time with the Mohawk, he absolutely has, I don't think that he does it naturally yet because he's asking, right? If he had been with them longer, maybe it may started to come more naturally. But the fact that he is, now I'm not saying the Mohawk have a dream and then no. I mean, they may have certain symbolism that live birds mean this, dead birds mean this. Like there's no question there. He has internalized that, right? He has learned that the fact, quote unquote, it's a fact for the Mohawk, right? I'm sure the Mohawk don't have a fact or don't have a symbolism guide for a mammoth. So there's nothing, or an elephant. There's nothing for him. There's nothing in the system that he learned that he, what he was able to internalize symbolically from the Mohawk that covers this. So it, I think it's a combination of being just involved enough with the Mohawk way of life.
Is symbolically a word?
I mean, it is now.
I mean, he's, isn't it just like just, symbolically?
Well, no, because symbol. We'll worry about it later. So
I know I'm just trying to conjugate the word in different ways to make it back to its core. And I'm like, I don't know what that word is.
What we know is that he was with the Mohawk for a specific amount of time, 2 years, maybe something like that. He was with the Mohawk for X amount of time. During that time, he learned language. He learned their language. He learned their customs. Like, you know,
we should be able to know way of life. How long he was gone based on when Jem was born and how old Jem was when he came back.
We can do that math later, but that is true. Those are two good time posts or telephone poles that we can look at. So he was with the Mohawk for however much time. During that time, he learned their language. He learned their ways, meaning he fit in enough. He got a wife. He had several kids, or, you know, lost several children, but they made several children. And he learned enough. I'm sure he learned more than live birds good, dead birds bad. I'm sure. This is just an example, right? Their discussion was about birds because she said what she dreamed about. So I'm sure he learned more facts about the symbol. About the symbol system. I know symbology is a word. He learned about Mohawk symbology. We know that because he knows about the birds or what he says. What we don't know is if he's internalized the all dreams have a meaning thing, or all things in life, or things in life have meaning. I'm sure to a certain extent he has. And I was about to kind of answer my own question, but then I'm like, well, no, that's not proof. That's not 100% proof. My question was the fact that not that he brings Brianna here, but the fact that he, through tears, through desperation, says, like, tell me, what do I need to do? Should I go do this? Anyone in that kind of desperation would want to seek counsel from someone that they trust. Like, that makes sense. I'm not knocking that. If you're a listener to our show, you're a fan of Outlander. Did you know that there's a new indie historical fiction novel that Diana Gabaldone wrote a foreword for? It's called Ian of New Scotland, and it takes place during the same time frame as A Breath of Snow and Ashes, only much further north. Those Highlanders sure did get around.
13-year-old Ian Robertson is homesick for the Highlands of Scotland. It's September 1773, and he has just arrived in Nova Scotia with his parents and little sister after the long, disastrous Atlantic voyage of the ship Hector. They wanted a new life in New Scotland, but the land agent lied to them. With no money, no food, no shelter, and winter fast approaching, how will they survive?
The author, Margaret McKay of Nova Scotia, draws on the true stories of her Highland ancestors. The book is full of history and culture, with so much about the Gaels, and even about the Indigenous people who helped them, the Mi'kmaq.
The book is good for grades 4 and up, but it's also great for historical fiction lovers of all ages. Ian of New Scotland is a classic tale of survival, like Little House on the Prairie books for Highlanders.
I think one of my favorite moments was when Ian was out exploring with his friends, forgot his shoes, and had to run back to get them, and was confronted with an incoming tide. And you'll have to read more to find out what happened to him and the tide and his shoes.
Ian of New Scotland is available now wherever books are sold online. Published by Braden Press of Nova Scotia. Braden is spelled the Gaelic way with two A's. For more info, visit bradenpress.com/outlander. That's Bradan press.com/outlander.
Do you think he asked her because of everything that went down with Roger, how he left and then came back later?
That's another layer. That's about the why. Let's go back to the why, but I'm on the what. The fact that he asked someone, her, Jamie, whomever, should I stay or should I go? Should I go fight for her? You know, whatever.
Well, because Roger came back and fought for her. So I'm just wondering if...
I understand, but I want to get the who or the why her secondary to the question he asked. Because that's separate. It's important, but it's separate. I'm almost done. So whoever he asks, it just happens to be Brianna he takes on this trip, is the fact that he asks another person to make for their opinion or to make the decision for him. Is that because of just the gravity of this? Because he can't he hasn't, is it related in any way, and it may not be, to him not completely internalizing the Mohawk system of symbology? That's my question. So, you know what I mean? So regardless of who he asks, the fact that he has to ask and there's no one there from the Mohawk tribe, obviously, to ask questions about what this could mean and what the sign means. Because there's no one to ask except his own people, obviously, because if he were with Emily, there'd be no question about going back. So it's kind of a rock and a hard place question. Now, the fact that he does ask someone, again, doesn't mean he hasn't internalized their symbology, their system, but because if he were with the Mohawk and had a big problem about something or a big question, a big existential question, I'm sure he absolutely would go to her grandmother or go to
the medicine woman.
Exactly. There's someone there that they would find counsel with, or if you're struggling with something, absolutely. I'm sure there are people there you could bounce ideas off of. So it's not it's a human thing, right? It is not a uniquely Mohawk or a uniquely white European thing. That is a human thing. So I'm not saying the fact that he asks her means he's not Mohawk. I'm just saying it's interesting that he's not dependent or not sure enough maybe in the symbology. So maybe I'm relating it to something that it's not related to. But the whole reason he brings her there is to show her that mammoth. And because of this whole experience and this it being a holy place and him wondering about his daughter and losing her, he's now worried about XYZ. So anyway, yes. Now to the who, I had never considered that. You're right. Him bringing or him asking Brianna.
He very specifically picked her.
Yes. Yeah.
Because him didn't tell her why. Like he literally was like, "Hey, let's go for a walk." Oh, BT Dubs, it's gonna take a few days to get back.
The telling her why thing was odd. Not telling her, that was odd. I can't come up with a defense or an argument for that. However, the fact that he chose her. Yeah, it's interesting. So the person, after all the stuff that was done to Roger, and that he stood for Roger, right? He stayed instead of Roger. Mm-hmm. He stayed with them, and he was completely a Christ-like sacrifice, right? He completely gave up his life, not his like life, death, wife, but his life with his people, with his family, with everything he knew to stay instead of Roger, because he knew that, you know, Roger had Brianna and she was pregnant and all of that. So it's more than that reason. Also, he was like a quote unquote Indian fanatic. He was so the whole book is set up for him to leave. Right. Book four sets us up and book five. No, it is book four. Excuse me. Book five is the hanging. Sorry. So, yeah, the whole book, their whole thing, he is into nothing but adventure. So he goes off with his friends and they're all from whatever different tribe. Right. When they were still at the ridge. So the whole book, Diana sets us up for him leaving. So it is not surprising that he would want to go stay with them. It is bittersweet that he does and that the cause of it is he is basically – I wouldn't say necessarily saving Roger's life. He is taking Roger's place, though, definitely. So, yeah, it's very interesting that he chooses Brianna because, in a way, he – although this has nothing to do with Roger, right? This is completely Ian's story. In a way, they had a connection, not before Roger, but before she saw Roger the second time, you know, after he came back. When she finds out she's pregnant, Roger's gone off looking for whatever. She's there at the ridge. She's pregnant. And, you know, Ian and Jamie talk and they're like, you know, well, I'll marry her, all that whole thing. Right. So there was a chance in a moment that they at least may have had to at some point get together just for her safety or the child's safety or whatever. So they have that shared background, even though they didn't do anything. He, at the very least, we don't know how attracted he was to her, but we do know that he wouldn't have had a problem with it. He would have survived is my point. So there's that history. And then, which may not be anything here, but there's that history. And then there's the history of Roger being abducted or sold, right? Into two people who then took him to the Mohawk. And Ian going with them to, Ian kind of, I guess you could say, kind of paying a price for his role in injuring, attacking, and selling Roger. Exactly. So you can, there's a lot of things you can make there, right? So the previous relationship, however deep it is or isn't, and then we have Roger in his role as, Ian in his role as when he was, Ian in his role as what he did to get Roger sold, given away, and taken into captivity. And then, and that would have been his first, I guess, transgression, right? Him lusting after his cousin or whatever, that's nothing. That's just a thing. It was just a conversation they had and he probably wouldn't have minded it. Boom, we're done. But yes, his quote unquote, the evil that he did, the transgression that he did was his involvement in selling Roger to the Mohawk or some people who then took him to the Mohawk. In Jamie's words, to get him lost, like make him lost. And then his first, and went on forever. I mean, went on for a long time. Like his major role, his attempt to make good or make better, make up in some way for what was done to Roger and his role in that was to take Roger's place. Now, his taking Roger's place was also, and this is going to sound really bad,
I'll be the judge of that.
I don't think he went into it with this thought, but while it absolutely was a selfless thing to do, he wasn't that mad about it. He knew it was a major thing. He knew it was a huge deal. He knew it was major in that he may never see his family and friends again. He knew that. But it wasn't just the fact that, oh my gosh, for my part, I have to atone for myself. I gotta do this. It was that and the fact that it was probably easier for him, maybe due to his age, but also due to his interest, right? He was unattached.
Well, it impacted less people.
Exactly. So yeah, because if it were Jamie, because Jamie was like, no, I'm going to do this. So if Jamie would have affected the entire Ridge, not just Claire, right? And of course, Brianna. Roger would have affected Brianna and their child. And Ian affects the feelings of other people, but he's not attached and he has no children. And he's got this crazy, crazy dude boner for learning more about the Native Americans.
Dude boner.
He's fascinated by that. Well, I guess a boner is a dude boner. Exactly. He's got that for living with them, traveling with them, learning from them. So anyway, so there's a whole bunch of this stuff going on. But yes, I think that the fact that he chooses Brianna.
Do you need me to restate why I mentioned? The reason that I said, do you think that he chose Brianna for this purpose is because basically if he went back now, it would be the same to in his mind's eye as when Roger, they rescued Roger and Roger came back and they said, don't come back until you know. And then Roger didn't come back for a while. He went off and thought about it. And then he came back and he did make the choice to go back and choose Brianna, right? And whoever's baby that ended up being. So I think that potentially because she would be in kind of the same spot as Emily, wherein they don't know why she may not know why he left, but if he made the choice to choose her and go back, that was it something that Brianna would do differently? You know what I mean? Because he can see the similarities between his wanting to go back and fight for Emily and Roger choosing to come back and fight for Brianna. I think he can see maybe some similarities and some symmetry in the two stories. Maybe.
Yeah, I think it's definitely worth considering. And so even though she does not want to be in this situation, she kind of bucks up and says, well, I am in this situation and it's only right for me to say something. So she says, stay. She says, you could fight Sun Elk, but you cannot fight Emily. And if Emily's made up her mind, you can't change it. But it's more than just Emily or Sun Elk. It's also all of the ties she has to her people. So you're not just trying to get Emily. She doesn't say these words, but what is implied or what I took was it's not just Emily bodily asking her if she's still in love with him, wants to come live with him. It's, yeah, there may be a hurdle in Sun Elk, likely. It's Emily's family. Is she willing to leave her family, her ties with her entire family? Does she have kids with Sun Elk? Is what Brianna does not say. Does she have kids with Sun Elk? You know, that's, you can't, it, that she's tied. If that's the truth, she's done. Like, she's not going to leave her babies, especially after losing all the babies. So it's a very difficult thing. And he decides to stay. They make their way back home and they still have like a 2 day or so trip or whatever. And they camp again. And when they camp, he asks for her father's name. He says that he'll light a candle for him if he is ever in a church again. And she gives it to him. And Bran asks, why not marry Lizzie? Like, you know, that she's been pining for you and she's no longer betrothed to Mr. Siff and she's free now.
Is that his official title now?
It's what I'm calling him.
Shouldn't he be Herr Siff?
What?
Isn't he German?
Oh, Herr. I'm thinking hair on your head. I'm like, what? No. Sure. Herr Siff. Zuf. He says he thought of it, but he said it would be like waking up next to his wee sister, and he's not that desperate yet.
I would think it would take more than desperation to make you want to sleep with your sister.
Like a gun or something. Like, yeah.
Well, and not even, I mean, there's something extra about somebody who sleeps with their sister or with family members. And it's not just, you know, desperation. I think there's definitely something else going on up top.
Or not going on up top.
Yeah. And that was chapter 70. Join us next time when we will be continuing our A Breath of Snow and Ashes read-along with chapters 71, entitled Black Pudding. I added the sound effect. And 72, entitled Betrayals. And as always, if you'd like to join us to continue the conversation, you can go to www.outlanderpod.com/group.
Again, a special thanks to co-producer Laura D. To find out more about how you can maybe become a co-producer and support us on Patreon, visit outlanderpod.com/Patreon.
And if you've ever been interested in owning some Outlander Pod branded merchandise, you can go to our shop at www.outlanderpod.com/shop.
As I said at the top, if you haven't joined our text community, why not? Text hello to 916-659-5112. And thank you, as always, so much for listening. We look forward to our next episode. Thank you to our generous partner, Zencastr, who offers high-fidelity podcasting. Check out Zencastr and use coupon code OUTLANDER20. Outlander20 for 20% off 3 months or 20% off for a year. Connect with us. Visit our website at outlanderpod.com. Find us on Facebook, facebook.com/outlanderpod. We'd love for you to join our Facebook community at outlanderpod.com/group. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at outlanderpod.